Today is April 8th, 2014. This is a second interview with... Do you pronounce your first name Allison? Is that...
Yeah.
That's what I figured. Allison Sewell. This interview is primarily being done for our Capitol Protest 2011 Oral History Project. And I'm Troy Reeves, the head of the UW Madison Oral History Program. So, Allison, as with the last session, could you say your name and spell your last name?
My name's Allison Sewell. Last name is S-E-W-E-L-L.
Okay. So, I'm going to check. So, I'm going to slide this a little closer to you. And as I said last time, I'm just going to need to project to make sure my questions get on the recorder.
Okay.
Your voice is fine where it's at. So we ended talking last time about your research and how it involved recordings.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you talked about this towards the end, but I don't think it hurts to get it back on the tape. So first off, why are interviews a needed part of the research you're doing?
Well, I'm trying to document what the German varieties of Wisconsin sound like. So not only is it necessary to make an audio recording so that I can listen to it later and do the analyses that I'm interested in doing, but also by creating these WAV and MP3 files of these interviews and then archiving them, then other researchers later on are, or even now, are able to also use that material. Because I'm just working on one, you know, with any project, it's a very specific thing for that one project. So you're only using maybe 2% of all the data that's in there.
Mm-hmm.
And especially since I'm interested in, or I've been focused on describing the linguistic structures and kind of piecing those results with social characteristics of my consultants, I'm still usually not talking about just the whole interview. I'm still only using very select pieces of the interview and combining those pieces in certain ways to make a point about how language changes, about how German varieties develop in situations of dialect contact, how German varieties develop in communities and within individuals who are bilinguals. So within communities that are bilingual and, mm-hmm. and within individuals that are bilinguals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I brought up my doing these interviews as far as like going out and recording them, how that relates to also my desire to be doing work that's meaningful to the communities, that's meaningful to outside of academia. And I feel like that documentation aspect of my research is something that people, I feel like they don't really care if I'm going to present about their German speech at a conference at UCLA. They're more interested in the fact that I want to preserve their stories, how they speak, and spread the word that they exist, that, mm-hmm. you know, that they speak a German variety that is this way. And I find that worth doing as well, especially since a lot of people, if they know anything about German varieties in the U.S., one of the first things is always Amish, you know, Pennsylvania Dutch, or they don't even know what it's called, but they mention, oh yeah, the Amish speak some type of German. Then maybe people know, oh yeah, there's people who spoke German in Texas, but a lot of people don't, even though they maybe have a sense that there was German settlement in Wisconsin, they don't realize that there are people alive today that still speak German. And kind of getting out the word. So
I have only three follow-ups to that.
Okay.
The first is sort of purely language based. You mentioned you I believe just referred to the people you interview as consultants. Is that the is that the language that linguistics, if you're so let me back up. So I'm interviewing you in oral history parlance, you're a narrator.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the term that oral history has glommed onto.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific term for interviewees or narrators in the linguistic world?
Well, there are definitely terms as far as how I don't really think I can generalize to saying that all linguistics uses that. I feel like different disciplines of linguistics use different terms, and it depends on what you're doing. I mean, some people would have they'd call them participants because they come in and they're participating in an activity, a task. They would call them subjects because they're studying them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people just in their works, they just label them. They'll just say, like, these are German speakers. The German speakers of blah, blah, blah. I feel like that's too broad because I'm not talking about all German speakers in Wisconsin. I'm talking about the only thing I know about is my consultants. And I call them consultants instead of informants, which is another term that's been used in the literature that I've read. But I chose consultants mostly because my advisor said that he said we need to pick a term. Mm-hmm. And I liked consultants because I'm consulting them and it puts them in the position of being the expert, kind of similar to narrator. It, you know, puts them in just kind of a position of describing what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
which I see that informants isn't necessarily negative, but yeah. So it's more a term that I chose.
Okay. So I think what I'm hearing here is, you know, as with narrator, you feel consultant is a term that's perhaps more empowering to the people that you're interviewing, whereas terms like subject or informant or even interviewee
mm-hmm.
Don't necessarily provide that. So do you feel it? Do you feel? I mean, I feel it matters to the people we interview that I call them narrators. I think, mm-hmm. again, it does provide a little bit of empowerment in the title. Do you mm-hmm. feel it's important to the people that you are talking to that they have that they're labeled in a way that makes them feel part of the project?
Definitely. And okay. I don't know if they, I'm not sure if or when they would ever know that I call them consultants, but I feel like it's definitely important how I talk about the people I work with, how I talk about that to others is definitely a big part of the work that I do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of labels have been ascribed to German speakers in the U.S. and one of them, and not just German speakers, in general, like talking about situations where there's a language that's not English being spoken. And there's a lot of really not empowering terms. So I've been very careful about that. And in my research group, so in like co-authorships, publications and stuff I've worked on with other people, I see that as kind of one of my jobs, is to really like make sure that all of our terms are right, that we're consistent about how we define things, and that we're not just putting labels on things, that we're not just, an example of that is there's a rhetoric about incomplete acquisition, how people incompletely acquire language, and I refuse to use any of that in my work, and so that means my co-authors have to not use it as well, because I refuse to say that my consultants incompletely acquired a language for a majority of reasons that probably aren't important to discuss right now, but definitely terminology, I feel like we should not just take that for granted, you know, that this is what people use in linguistics, so I should use it. I feel like we can create the terminology that we're using mm-hmm. and justify it because we are, you know, the researchers. So
is this perhaps another way for you to we talked last time and maybe even the pre-interview about your interest in data, but the context of the data.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can just gather data and you can call somebody an informant, but
mm-hmm.
if you provide context, then you start to try to humanize these
exactly
people.
Yeah,
and then to have these labels attached to them means something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. And also just, I mean, I think that's pretty much it. Just humanizing it and...
Mm-hmm. So two more things here. So I get frustrated, and I've been frustrated since I really started being an oral historian, is you read an article and you see the footnote and it says interview in author's possession or interview held by author. It sounds like your work that you're trying to do is not only for you, but you are interested in trying to help others, whether it's your cohort or future generations or whatever. Was that something that you made a conscious decision about, or was that something that Joe or other people helped you to see? How did that all come about, basically?
Yeah, basically, it was definitely Joe's suggestion to store the recordings in the Max Cott Institute Sound Archive. It's a project. I don't know if he got started on it, but the Max Cott Institute came into possession of tapes, reels of of older recordings. Basically, the German and recordings on German American varieties. And so they've started collecting those, digitizing them. And the very first time I went out to do interviews, when I wrote the consent form, I didn't put in there that I said that I was going to keep the interviews. And I wrote it in a way and that the IRB, you know, I got approved by the IRB, but I said that the interviews would stay on, you know, my backup hard drive, password protected, for 3 years, and that was it. And that was the first time I did a project here. And then after that, Joe said, well, from now on, when you go out to do interviews, you should use my consent form and be on my protocol. So I had done the training as IRB certified, so he just added me onto his protocol to be participating in this language documentation project of languages in the Upper Midwest, not just German, but also English and other languages. Mm. So any time after that I did interviews, I used his consent form, which says that the recordings will be stored in the archive. And I found myself kind of talking about it in the way I described it to you when I would tell my consultants what the consent form was for, where the recordings would be stored, and how they would be used. Because it's also available to the public. So, for example, if one of my consultants' relatives wants to listen to it, they can. Mm-hmm. I make sure that they know that they can contact us if they want a copy of, if they want to talk about the recording or to receive access to it in some way, they can contact the Institute. So, it was conscious, but I definitely think Joe knew, it was his idea, and he kind of pushed me in that way without explicitly saying, like, see how good of a thing this is. But I think he knew all along that that's kind of a better way of handling the data.
And it sounds like intuitively you are doing what we oral historians call informed consent, meaning you explain to them before they sign that not only are these interviews being used for my research, but they're going to end up in a public repository where others can use them.
Yeah, exactly. I say that on the telephone when I'm talking to them about scheduling the interview, just describing, because it could be scary if someone just says, oh, I want to come talk to you, and then they all of a sudden they start setting up equipment of some kind. So I make sure they know before we arrive, you know, that we do want to record. But then I always, again, frame that in the context that it's to document our conversation. Mm-hmm. So the
last thing about the interviews themselves, and then I want to give you space to talk more about your dissertation research, is the interview itself. I mean, you have in front of you my topic list that was created by myself and a fellow graduate student to start to ask you questions about the protests. What sort of protocol or topic list or questionnaire do you have that you give to what you call your consultants before you or during your interview?
Well, I don't actually give them anything, but I bring something myself to follow along to kind of guide my questioning. It's just something that we came up with. I think Joe kind of gave some ideas of things, and then we've just been continually adapting it since we started this stuff in 2011. I think every time we've gone out on an interview, there's been a new protocol, whether it's changing, you know, the order. But generally, we have questions. Right now, I guess I can talk more about the one I have now, since that's kind of where we're at in the development, the evolution of the protocol. I ask biographical information to get their names, also birth dates on the recording. We'll talk about names of family members, birth dates, death dates, also where people have lived. That type of information, I realized some of that is important to my work now. Some of it may be important to other people, and it's really hard to figure that out, whereas you can just ask someone and they know it and just tell you. Maiden names, especially of women. And then I am interested in documenting as much as I can about their exposure to German and English throughout their life, and their exposure to English and use of English and use of German throughout their life. So I have kind of a list of different domains. By domains, I mean like people they've used it with, context. So you may say with your parents, with your grandparents, with your brothers and sisters, with your cousins, in school, at church, in town, with neighborhood with neighbors, you know, kids and adults. And then I kind of have little notes to the side about which one of those categories are applicable for multiple time periods. So for parents, for example, it would say like, okay, as a kid, as a teenager, as an adult, you know, until when? And usually it's until the parents passed away. So then I can kind of create that. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes they used mostly English with their parents after a certain point, even though their parents were still alive. So trying to figure out those little details are very important to the picture I'm trying to shape about language use and language exposure. Mm-hmm. So it's actually just one page, and it just I have this to kind of guide my questions, the biographical information, and then that kind of... It's it kind of looks like a little chart. It just has like the list of domains and then kind of which ones do I need to talk about over certain time periods. And then I just kind of use that to guide the conversation, make sure mentally that I'm checking off that I've gotten all these different points. Right now I'm doing second interviews with people, so I know a lot of this information already. And at this point I'm making a note in a second piece of paper, a second sheet, that has specific questions about things that they mentioned the first time. So I could say, you know, you told us last time that you visited Germany. How many times have you been there? Can you tell me more about that experience? Mm-hmm. And then just kind of to guide that conversation. And for certain people in the first interview, we did go into details about their trips to Germany. But in other contexts, we didn't dig as deep. I think that's because we were all kind of like learning what we wanted to get out of these interviews and how to do stuff. Maybe someone comes in, interrupts the conversation, and we don't ever go back to it. So that's why these second interviews are needed. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So it sounds like the first interview is a combination of what we call close-ended questions. So yes or no or factual statements, but then some open-ended questions as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Where perhaps then the second interview is more open-ended because you've gathered the data, so to speak. So again, it sounds like to me you're a little bit of data and context in the first interview, but the second interview is a lot of context content to allow them to give you more information. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's a fair assessment, but I'll say that it wasn't intentional. It was just kind of that I realized by asking a yes or no question, I was not really getting a lot of details and not a lot of speech. I mean, I'm also interested in hearing them use German. Mm. And if they just say yeah or nein, then we're it doesn't really tell me much other than the characteristics of those words. So that was more of kind of as I started transcribing data, I realized, oh, you need to ask less yes or no questions. Mm-hmm. And then you can kind of kill two birds with one stone. You can get more linguistic data, as in just production, right? Don't care about content. But then you can also get more content, which I also need. Mm-hmm. So... just kind of a conscious decision on my part that to kind of switch my interview style.
So, I mean, intuitively, I'll just say it, you're becoming an oral historian. So, I mean, intuitively, you know, they need to know what they're signing,
yeah.
Which is what oral historians, again, call informed consent. And intuitively, you're realizing that close-ended questions, as a linguist, is only giving you so much, but it's also... not getting you the content and the context that you're really needing.
Yeah, I find oral history very interesting. And I definitely, after this research, one way to stay involved with these communities, whether or not I'm actually collecting data as part of a research project, or whether or not I'm just doing something that I will call an oral history with the local historical societies there would like to do oral history projects. Mm-hmm. But they need people who speak German to do those types of oral histories. Mm-hmm. And not only can I speak German, but I have 4 years of experience now of doing this type of interview. So hopefully I can get involved with these local... I mean, I already know these local historical societies, so I can continue to be involved with them, but rather than being, you know, kind of on the outside, I'd like to maybe have that be a hobby that I develop. And, mm-hmm. 'Cause right now I'm doing it as a hobby too, but it's also my job. But,
right.
Yeah.
That's great. So last time we talked about the research that became your master's thesis, I don't think, at least directly, I asked about now your dissertation work. I mean, I think you've indirectly talked about it,
mm-hmm.
But I want to ask it directly, your research that's leading to your dissertation.
Well, it's... I decided that I wanted to not only look at linguistic structure, but I also wanted to consider these social variables. So that's where I mentioned last time about being a sociolinguist. That's kind of title in the sense that I'm interested in the relationship between language use, the use of certain structures, and then the social characteristics of the person using that language and using the language in that way. So really, I just looked at kind of what's been done on German-American varieties and the main difference between my approach and a lot of those other works. Well, I mean, the first thing is that nobody's written a dissertation on varieties, these types of varieties in Wisconsin, like the varieties spoken by second to fifth generation Wisconsin-born speakers. So that in itself was a pretty easy, like, clear contribution to the field. But then on top of that, because there is a lack of previously made recordings, there are some, but not enough. And the formats for those previously made recordings are very different than the recordings, than what I'm using. Also, I should mention, in our interviews, we also have our consultants translate sentences from English into German. That's a very structured that's something totally different than just the free conversation. We started doing that task, and now I've kept it as part of my interviews currently, but I see the translation task much differently now. At first, I thought this was the main point of the interview, but it's totally flipped over the years. And now, even for the linguistic structure, but obviously also for the content, because they're not saying any original content, they're not saying their own content, but even for the linguistic structure, I see the translations as being just supplementary and just something that if they're doing something in free conversation and then I know, okay, I asked them to translate the sentence in English where they may have produced this. How do they do that in the sentence? And then I know for sure everybody's done it. Everyone's been given the opportunity to do it. So it's kind of just like a way of checking some patterns and things I'm finding in the free conversation. But my analysis is definitely focused on the free conversation. And that sets it apart from other studies as well. Because a lot of them rely on translations. And then thirdly, as far as like a contribution to the field, I'm looking at variation between individuals. Rather than comparing my consultants to European German speakers, or rather than comparing them to people who spoke German in Wisconsin earlier and were recorded earlier. A lot of the work on Texas German has... because there is this rich history of recording Texas German, they had these comparisons that they could make, again, using translations, though, as the basis for the analysis. I don't have that. As I said, there's some recordings, but very little free conversation was recorded in those recordings. So I'm comparing my consultants to each other to try and talk about language change, language contact, dialect contact, these things that have to do with kind of diachronic, you know, has to do with change over time, but I don't actually have that real-time evidence. But in linguistics, that's done a lot, where you compare a snapshot of the population and look at apparent time change, mm-hmm. or look at variation between individuals to try and figure out if change is... if language change is happening, or if this just happens to be variation between speakers. We call it stable variation. So a variation that exists but doesn't necessarily indicate a change. It's just there. So those are things, I mean, those are the big things, and it was kind of a combination of me trying to figure out how I can get the word out, as I was saying before, that like, hey, look at all these recordings, look at all this data, people, and but then also be able to say something about it. And really, I'm just trying to give as descriptive of a picture as I can of the situation, but then do it in ways that are also new as far as the new methods and the new, you know, the new type, new format for the interviews, a new approach to looking for change rather than always comparing it to older recordings and things like that. So. It's a huge project. It continues to shrink, which is a good sign, as in I keep shedding some parts of it. But right now I'm at the point where I'm collecting these second interviews and on the days I'm not collecting data, I'm transcribing data. So my hope is by the end of this summer, the timeline my advisor and I laid out was for me to have all my data collected and all my data transcribed. And the transcriptions are, I found it really hard to actually analyze data when I was also transcribing. So I just basically said, I'd like to just transcribe everything and have it all there and then go back and actually start analyzing and looking for these things. And that's the plan. And then also these transcripts along with the recordings will hopefully be useful. I feel like a lot of times when someone is told, I mean, I know when I was told, oh, there's all these recordings that, you know, you can use for research. So a lot of the recordings in the Mexicata Institute Sound Archive are not transcribed. And, you know, it's great that there's a 2-hour interview, but you don't know what's in it. So another hope I have is, and this is part of, I kind of built it into writing my dissertation. It's part of completing this project is creating this massive amount of transcription to accompany all these recordings. And then I have a spreadsheet. I'm also pulling out basic information about people so that, again, other people will know who's in there.
Mm-hmm. Great. I want to ask one more question about your research, and it's a question you're supposed to ask questions you have a decent idea of the answer to, but I don't recall. I've looked through the book Wisconsin Talk.
Mm-hmm.
Were you involved with Joe and others in that book, and if so, how?
I didn't write a chapter, but I wrote the index. I did the indexing for the book, and also just basic copy editing and formatting. But I didn't actually contribute to the volume. I wasn't asked to. I'm assuming because there was already two very German-heavy chapters, and they were talking about multiple different languages that are spoken in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. There was the chapter by Antje Petty on education, mm-hmm. and then Felicia Luck's chapter about older immigrant languages, where German was featured she discussed all the situation of all older immigrant languages. Mm-hmm. And both Antje and Felicia, for the particular scopes of those chapters, were definitely the experts on. Felicia's dissertation dealt with language shift, and she used a German community as kind of a model, but she, by talking about older immigrant languages, she was talking about general language use patterns for all older immigrant languages in Wisconsin. So, I didn't contribute to that book in any way other than basically as a editor.
Okay.
But I'm acknowledged in that capacity.
Okay, thank you. One other thing, I'm pointing at the folder that has your resume or CV in it, mm-hmm. and there's a couple of publications. Are those publications from your research or part of helping others with theirs? I'm thinking there's like a couple of, like there was a 2014
mm-hmm.
forthcoming, or either actually has been published, and then a 2013.
Yeah, so the, there's a lot of presentations, and almost all the presentations are my work. I like presenting more than writing, but you have to do both, or it's good to do both. There's a reason to do both. The earlier publication, the one from 2013, was not my idea. It was a project I worked on. The one that's forthcoming right now with Joe, it's one that's where I'm actually the leading author. It's just me and Joe. That one, again, wasn't really my idea, but basically it was, I had an issue with, actually that first article, the one in 2013, I had an issue with the structure we were looking at. We were looking at this structure called parasitic gapping construction, which had been written about in linguistic syntactic theory pieces. And I just said, well, you know, we need to figure out how the heck people actually feel about this, because a lot of theoretical literature uses intuition judgments. So the researcher says, I think this sentence is ungrammatical, so this sentence is ungrammatical. And the researcher maybe will ask one or two other linguists, and they also think it's ungrammatical. So this sentence is ungrammatical for English, because we say it is. And that bothered me. So bothered Joe, too, as someone who thinks that doesn't really, I mean, we're just data points, just, you know, like we could, but it's not, that's generalizing. So the second, the one that's, will be coming out in 2014, in the fall, actually, part of a book chapter. Joe was asked to write a chapter in a book, and he said, hey, you know, do you actually want to work on this? Like, really get some data on this and find out what people think. And I said, yeah, I'll work with you on this. So it was kind of like something he and I had, something I had expressed to him. Like, it wasn't really that I said I want to work on this project, but it was more of I'd said, this bothers me, and I don't really feel comfortable doing anything else with this thing until we figure out how people really feel about this. And so then he just basically, he got an invitation to write a book chapter and then said, you know, I'd like to do this, but you have more ideas about this and you're a little bit more passionate about working on it. And but definitely, I mean, so I'm the lead author because I did write everything. I designed all the instruments. I processed all the data. I did all the figures. But it's definitely a co-authorship because he helps me, you know, guides me with decision making. We communicate all the time about everything. There's never any decision made, any word in place, any period in place, anything that we haven't both looked at and given the go. So yeah, so far in print, there's actually nothing that is actually like me saying I'm going to put out this piece. But my dissertation will probably be the first thing. Oh, there is something forthcoming that was a presentation of mine that I turned into an article. Mm-hmm. But it's so weird when you work on projects because, you know, that right now, I'm waiting on the reviewer's comments for that. But I'm so far beyond that now in my dissertation that I almost don't want to publish it because I want to put a footnote that's like, hey, in the year that it took for this to actually get published, I now have way more data and much cooler stuff. But it takes that long to do everything. I mean, I did the presentation. We decided to make a volume. We had to write it up. We had to send it. I mean, so now we're over a year later, actually, and it's just now in these final stages. So that one is a presentation that I came up with and I did. But it was such an early stage of my work. It was before I did my prelim, before I, you know, really had a clear outline for my dissertation. So that's kind of funny how that works out. And it's an interesting question that you asked, because if you look at my CV, I mean, all of those publications kind of have different stories and different motivations, and I played different roles in all of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I guess could be part and parcel of joint authorship, right? I mean, when you're working with somebody, it might be your idea, it might be their idea.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously provide something to it because your name's on it.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all going to have, because they're all probably going to have different people working on it, so they're all going to have different start, middles, and ends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess we will at least get to start for a few minutes here talking about the protest, but I want to give you space if there's anything else you want to say about your research.
Just that I feel that it's really important for me to finish my dissertation and let people know that it's finished, even if it's not actually a published book, even if it's just, you know, in the library. Because I've told these people for years now that, you know, we're working on this stuff, and I'd like to give them and their family something to read and refer to. A lot of these people give their time to create these church histories, to create these family genealogies, family histories. That's so much time. And I'd like to show them that someone else besides them was interested in telling their story too.
Mm-hmm.
So that really is the main thing, that the main reason that I'm still here working on the project. And it's not really about, at this point in my life, it's not about me finishing it so that I can go on and get a job. I'm not planning on applying for jobs as a professor. So for me, I feel like I could start applying for jobs now, but I'm not at a point with that project that I feel like I want to leave it. And I feel like if anybody ever asked me, you know, why did you just stop, I wouldn't be able to give them an honest answer. So fortunately, I have support in my life, people in my life who support me moving forward and kind of taking time, figuring out this transition from, you know, working on all this to moving on to another part of my life. And so I, you know, that finishing the dissertation, finishing this project, wrapping up, you know, making sure all those transcripts, everything's in the archive, everything's labeled, that's something that is really important for me to do. And again, not necessarily because it's part of, you know, making sure that I get a job. I just feel like that's something that I need to do, and I can, so mm-hmm. I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're now going to sort of shift, we are shifting from You know, Allison is as teacher researcher to going back to the initial talk we had about your work as a TA, specifically as it pertains to the 2011 protests. So my first question is, so how involved in you, how involved were you in politics, or if at all, up through that 2010 election?
I was only involved in political things related to the TAA. I mean, I got involved with the TAA in 2009 when I started grad school. But, you know, and we had people who were talking about the importance of the election where Governor Walker was elected. And I remember Tom Barrett came to campus, and I remember someone in the TA sending out like an announcement of his visit and saying like, this guy could be the next governor. Like, come on guys, we need to go out and like support him. And, but I didn't really understand or think about the role that a governor had or the role that local politicians and state politicians really had, until after they started wielding their power, to put it lightly.
So I guess then, so you were teaching that semester, mm-hmm. which would be the end of the fall was the election, but then really the spring semester.
Mm-hmm.
So when do you recall hearing about what ends up being the budget repair bill and then of what its effect has on collective bargaining? Do you recall where you are when you hear about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was involved with the TAA's campaign, the I Heart UW campaign, which was originally conceived before we knew anything about the budget repair bill. We just wanted to do something to get the discussion, you know, basically there was a new administration. They had said some things about education. We knew some funding with education, some bills about funding with education were coming up. We wanted to do something to let them know, like, hey, if you haven't heard about us, we exist. And we are going to make some noise. And so we had planned all that. I mean, those handouts and everything, you know, we had people sign these Valentines and been doing all this stuff. I think we started doing that maybe 2 weeks before. I'm not sure exactly when we got things printed and everything. But, I mean, I remember taking the Valentines around to people in my department and having people in my department sign them and gathering them and taking them to the TAA office. This was all before they announced the budget repair bill. So at that point, I was mostly just, as far as political involvement, just issues related to, you know, myself and my colleagues and things on campus. But This was the first time I was actively involved in trying to reach out to people higher up. But it made sense to me why we were. I remember just things being passed around on the internet when the budget repair bill was released. And then we have some email lists, different email lists with the TAA, where people were like explaining, like, this is what this means. This is what this is. This is how they're doing this. And people asking questions like, wait, how can they, what? And, you know, just kind of doing all this through emails. And then on, so that was, you know, I'm looking at the paper here, and that was released.
Yeah, we're reversed. This
is the first page.
Let's see. Let's take it over. Actually, it goes in, so these are the first events, and it goes up. So Friday 11th is a budget repair bill, and then Friday the 14th is the iHeart, I think it says.
Yeah. So, I mean, the 11th through the 14th must have just been, like, I don't remember anything specific, but like I said, I remember kind of trying to figure out what it meant, and I think we were all trying to figure out what we were going to do.
Because you had this event planned.
Yeah.
Because you were going to take the Valentines up there anyway. And
right.
Now it's become part of...
Yeah.
Or could become part of a much larger thing.
And I don't remember what day it was when I went up to testify. That's after that, though, I think.
Yeah, I think that let's see, so...
I, in I my,
it's either 15th, 16th, maybe?
Yeah.
It's definitely that week. It's the week of Valentine's Day that there are people in line trying to testify.
Yeah, because there was, like, I think it was that Thursday or Friday. But yeah, it was definitely that week. But yeah, on that Monday, basically, I was planning on attending the event. And as I said, we've been gathering Valentine's for a while. And then I think it was all just through emails where people were just like, okay, so we're going to do this event, but we're going to keep everything, but we're just shifting the focus. Rather than it being like, hey, we want to let you know that we love UW, we love education, please don't break our hearts, was kind of a theme we had thrown around. As and instead, we're just, you know, we're going to really make it about, like, I mean, it was a lot softer. I think that rhetoric was much softer than we maybe would have come up with if we would have been just reacting. Mm-hmm. It's probably a good thing that we that we weren't just reacting and coming up with something like "screw you" in response. Instead, we already had all this stuff. That was a much softer. I don't know if it was good or bad, but. Yeah, we planned to go up and deliver stuff, and I mean, I have this memory of, you know, it was a weekday, so I had stuff I had to do. I mean, I knew I had to teach that day, and I had other stuff. I'm sure I had class and other stuff that day, too, but I know that I had blocked out a time when I could go up to the Capitol to do that. So I did that on that Monday, and I remember I wasn't actually part of the group of teaching assistants that went up to his office to dump stuff, and that was, I'm pretty sure, because there was a time conflict about when they wanted to go versus when I had stuff related to teaching and going to class. But I still went up with some friends. We walked up to the Capitol, and and we're just out there. I don't think we had a sign or anything on that day. Yeah.
So when did you decide that you wanted to testify?
Well, I got a phone call from Matt Morris, who at the time was on the Stewards Council. I just knew him from being in the TAA, and he called my cell phone and just said, so the Finance Committee, Joint Finance Committee, is going to be voting on this, but before they can vote, you know, there's a certain time period where people, you know, or like there's a, it's actually, it wasn't a time period. It was just that before they voted on it, they have to allow for people to come. And he's like, we're trying to get as many people as we can down here because the more people that are here, the longer that delays the vote. That's what we thought. Because for some reason, which I haven't actually looked into the law, but for some reason, Matt and others thought that basically they had to let people speak about it, and if people had something to say, they had to let them say it, and they had to let everybody who had something to say it before they could move on. But that turned out obviously not to be the case. But I don't know where they came up with that. But that's what I was told, and I thought, okay. And it was in the evening because I had just made dinner, and so then I said I would put my dinner in my Tupperware and bring my homework and just come up. And so I went up and. I guess it would have been like 5:30 or something, and then put my name. We had to go upstairs to this area and put our names down and get a little. Oh no, I think that was it. We just put our names down. We had to fill out a form and put our names down. And that's how I met Jackson, because he was in line right next to me, and so we put our names in at the same time. And so then we waited out in this hallway for a long time. And, I mean, it never occurred to me to leave, but I don't know why exactly I stayed that long either. I think it was because I thought, like, oh, sure, like, I understand, like, we want a lot of people here, but I wasn't really expecting for there to be so many people, but I didn't think about that. I think once I was there, I was just kind of like, there are a lot of people that are mad about this. Because it was not all TAA people, by no means, and, we waited in that top area for a while, and at some point they closed all the doors and wouldn't let people come in and listen anymore because it was supposed to be open to the public. People were really mad about that. At one point they stopped taking people in, and they were arguing amongst themselves, I guess, about whether to keep going, and people were banging on the doors, and then at some point I was moved with other people. We were moved into another room where there was all these chairs. Because before we were just sitting out in the hallway. And that's where we stayed for most of the like late evening into the like early morning, was in this like other room. And in that other room, there was like a big TV projector, either a TV or a screen or something, because they were showing the testimonies. And then there was just one or two people, like I think one guy who would just come back and call off two people's names, and those two people would run up and then they'd go. I remember I saw Marty Beal, and I'd seen his picture before, and like he was sitting eating a fudgesicle, because they gave out food at one point, and I had this weird feeling of like, that's Marty Beal eating a fudgesicle over there. Okay. But he was waiting too. I don't think he ever went. But that moving into that room was weird. I mean, I have a lot of vivid memories from that, because that's when you actually got to see what people were saying and hear people. Before, the hours before that, I don't know how many hours, I don't remember when exactly I got moved into that room, but the hours before that were just us waiting around, singing and talking to each other, and then moving down a hallway and then into that room. I don't know exactly. I didn't get to hear any of the testimonies in there, and I don't know how long they had people in that room, but definitely like towards the later part, because that's where I was when basically I was in that room still when they called my name to go. And so they called me and one other person. I think they were calling two or three people at a time. Mm-hmm. But at that point, like a couple of the members of the committee had already left. I remember hearing Robin Bose say that he had to leave because he had brunch the next morning. And watching the video thing was weird too, because, you know, you got to see how like completely cold and like, okay, thank you for that. You know, just very, okay, thanks for your time. You know, even though someone's up there like sobbing and they're, to see that dynamic and see that, and different people were doing different things. Again, something I wasn't really sure what I was going to say, what other people were saying, until we were in this room. And I don't know whose idea it was to start projecting stuff. But that created this very interesting experience, I think, for all of us sitting in there. Because we all were actually experiencing that together. And then there was the owner of Fontana Sports. I was really struck by his testimony. He started out by saying that he was a private business owner and didn't have employees that were unionized, but that this would hurt private business owners, and that he has many employees that work, you know, part-time, that are students or work staff. There are various things that where he basically just was talking from the perspective of, like, I'm a private business owner who brings in millions of dollars to the state of Wisconsin, and I'm telling you why this, from my perspective, is not a good thing. And that was a really great thing that he did, I feel like. I mean, didn't do anything, obviously, but to hear all these different perspectives from people who were teachers, who, you know, had gotten off work, driven there, and who had to leave because they had to, you know, be up to be with their students the next day, even though, you know, by, it was like midnight or one, I think, when people actually started leaving, but then that's when some parts of the committee members had started leaving. And so, yeah, at some point they called my name, but I was with the other two people who they called. We were the people who got brought to the room, but then had to sit there and listen to them say that they were adjourning and going home. So we sat there. And
so you were almost next in line, basically.
Yeah, we were the ones that were called in. But then when we got there, nobody was testifying. They were talking amongst themselves and then decided to go home. And then there was this really... afterwards, that was really weird, because it was so quiet after that, after everybody was there, and then we just sat there. Me and I don't remember the guy next to me. I don't remember if he was a student or anything. I mean, I remember what he looks like, but I didn't know him or anything. And we just kind of sat there for a couple minutes and watched people, like, leave, and then, like, someone came in to, like, clean up the drink cups and the pitchers of water and stuff, and we were just like, oh, so we're done, I guess. And
so did you, after that, did you just head home?
Well, I went downstairs and I actually ran into my friend Jill, and she said that I looked like shit. because she would, but she's a great friend. And it was weird because I'm hearing myself saying weird so many times, but I've never talked about this before. But I guess it was kind of a weird experience because, you know, all of a sudden there's people around me for hours and hours. Then there's nobody around. And then the first person I run into after this, like, you know, lapse of people being around me is someone that I know and a close friend of mine. What are the odds of that? But she was just there checking out she had come later, and she never gotten, she'd just come and seen the people that were in the rotunda, which I had no idea that was happening, that people had just flooded into the rotunda, because I was up in this, moving around in these rooms. I had no idea. But she said she got, you know, heard that all these people were down there and came to check that out. And so then she said I looked like shit and then asked me if I eat dinner, and I thought about it and I said, yeah, but that was a while ago. So then she lived by me at the time, so we just walked home. And so yeah, she walked me home. And I didn't go to... I wrote Joe an email and told him that I'd just gotten home. It was like 2:33 in the morning. And I had class. I had his seminar, was the only seminar I had that next day. And then I taught. But I just said, I'm going to go teach, but then I'm coming home and going to sleep. I won't be in class. And he just said, okay.
Well, Allison, I think there's much more to talk about this, but we've reached the time where I need to wrap up and move on. So we will pick up there next time.
Okay.
So thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate
it. Thank you.